So we have a killer whale and a bunny here, and we'll see if they can play a part. Good morning. This is really exciting for me. I'm happy to be here in this place. Last night, like many, many nights for the last 4 months, as Roger, our son, who's almost 2 years old, was falling asleep, I heard the mum, 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 mum. Dad, 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 dad. Hi, dad. Hi, dad. Mom, mom, mom. Mom, mom, dad, dad. Oma, oma, oma. Mom, mom, mom. This is a common refrain we hear night after night after night after night. It's something that I thought was really, really cute, but I didn't really think much more about it. That wasn't until about 2 weeks ago. I was doing some reading in children's psychology for a school course, and it turns out that when toddlers and small children are putting themselves to sleep, it's very common when they've experienced a trusted and caring environment to repeat the names of the people that have cared for them and trusted them. In many cases, often, if a family is to have a pet, they'll repeat that name. So if we had a dog, and if that dog's name was BB, every single night, we would hear, mom, mom, dad, dad, bibi, bibi, oma, opa, every single night. Now, what was interesting to me about this reading and this story is that it was linked with some neuroscience. And I'm not a scientist, but I'll do my best to explain these findings that they shared. What they said is they took a brain scan of a toddler who was being comforted and cared by a loved one, so probably a parent, and the parts of the brain that were activated in that comforting motion, the hormones that were released and the parts of the brain that were activated on this brain scan were exactly the same parts of the brain that were activated and the hormones released when that toddler fell asleep reciting the names of the people that the toddler loves. So, what names are we saying? When are we saying them, and when are we repeating them? It's remarkable to think about the significance of just these names that we're saying when they change our physiological response to our surroundings. Who we remember, who we name, where, when, and how often we repeat those names might help us make sense of who we are, where we're going, and how we're supposed to get there. As a people with a foundation on Christ, shaped by our Anabaptist history and our Anabaptist brothers and sisters long times ago. So who do we as Christians remember, and who do we at HMC remember? In songs, in prayers, in teachings. This week, it's my favorite church holiday besides Easter, All Saints Day. Do we practice it at HMC? It's not a trick question. I don't think we do. I just wanted to make sure. Do we? We do practice it. I know we do the lighting of the candles, but do we practice All Saints Day? This is the larger, broader church holiday where people who are considered saints in the church, named and unnamed, people who don't have their own day dedicated to them, are all put together in this one day. Prayers are said, candles are lit, and we as the present church today remember and are surrounded by their witnesses and by their spirits. So it's not totally a Mennonite holiday, but I think it's somewhat fitting, especially for today. So if we at HMC petitioned the larger global Mennonite church for some kind of a Mennonite and a Baptist global history cloud of witnesses kind of day, who would we remember? At HMC, who would remember? Who is in our community of the dead? Who is in this cloud of witnesses who always surround us and who are always at work in our lives and in this church? Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. Look side to side. These are your witnesses. And we also look to the dead. Maybe we remember Katharina Hütter, who worked as a maid in a household in Tyrol. This household was a secret meeting place for night gatherings of Anabaptists in the 1530s. She was drawn to their teachings of peace, their loyalty to this way of life, despite the persecution they faced because of it. Many of them hid in the forest close to the household to escape government authorities, and she often brought them meals. She cared for them. She was baptized by her soon-to-be husband, Jacob, and their arrest followed shortly after. Her husband was killed, and she was released on the condition that she recant, which means she would say that she was no longer an Anabaptist and she'd made a huge mistake. She recanted. She fled Tyrol, continued supporting the Anabaptist gatherings, was arrested again, escaped prison, spent 2 years essentially couch surfing, being cared for and caring for other Anabaptists in small secret gatherings. She was arrested again, and then she was killed. Katharina Hütter, in our cloud of witnesses here today. How might Katharina's recantation, couch surfing, caregiving, care receiving, prison escape, and execution guide us today? Maybe we remember 1528, the unnamed women in the household of painter Bartley Dill, and the wife and the maid of Sebastian S., and Sigmund Trebenef's maid. Maybe we remember these unnamed women who somehow were associated with Anabaptism because they were all arrested for it and they all recanted. From then, we don't know anything else about them. We don't know what they did. We don't know if they joined other Anabaptists. We don't know if they were arrested again and executed. We have no idea. Like Katharina, did they flee? Did they care for other Anabaptists as they worshiped together, practicing a life of peace? These five, maybe more, unnamed women in our cloud of witnesses, how might their arrests, recantations, and unknown histories, continued lives and deaths, guide us today? So these are two different examples of the same time period of people that we need to consider in our Anabaptist cloud of witnesses. And they're somewhat obvious. I found them in an Anabaptist history book. But how about those that surround us in the community of the dead here today who have never been in a book? A great-great-aunt who cooked, cleaned, and cared for five children after their parents died. A great-grandfather who cared for the earth. An uncle who is a conscientious objector. A parent who bathed you, fed you, and loved you. A brother in the church who rejoiced in the growth of his garden. How do they guide us today? How about those witnesses who did not practice an Anabaptist faith, who practiced a different faith or no faith at all? Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi. So what's at stake here in who we remember, in whose names we repeat night after night? Martha read the scripture in 1 Corinthians 3:11 about our foundation being built on Jesus Christ. And it's true. I'm not here to debate that, but I think that the cloud of witnesses can help give shape to that statement and that theological foundation. Sometimes our foundation is Jesus Christ, while nevertheless true, is caught up in violent and unfaithful habits. Bombs have been dropped, killing camps have been built, and residential schools have been justified on a particular version of that foundation of Jesus Christ. Our cloud of witnesses shows us how to make sense of this foundation. So let us pay careful attention to this community of the dead that the Spirit breathes into our lives today. The ones beside you and the ones we can't see, they might shape us into a faithful people. Earlier this week, I was at a coffee shop determined to get this out. I've been thinking about this sermon for about 4 weeks, really excited, a million ideas, but I didn't want to put anything down on paper for fear that I would rewrite it a million times, so I waited last minute. But I was at this coffee shop, Durand Coffee Shop, and they have a bunch of books there, and I saw the Martin Luther, not the Martin Luther one, the Malcolm X autobiography sitting there. Like, Malcolm X, I have loved at a distance. His quick intellect, cutting tongue, and hardcore commitment to what he felt to be true have haunted me for over a decade, but I never got to know him, so to speak. I figured I'd be better off diving deeper into some other civil rights leaders who were more on board with my pacifist convictions. But I needed to procrastinate the writing of this sermon, so I picked up the book. I read and read and read and read, and later that evening I watched the Spike Lee film, 1992, on Malcolm X. Malcolm X had teeth. If you don't know who he is or you don't know much about him, it's okay. I wrote a letter to him on behalf of myself and HMC, and I'll read it to you now so you'll get to know him a bit more by the end of this service. Dear Malcolm X, I'm writing to you for part of a sermon. All Saints Day is coming up. Do you know this? It's hard to imagine you wouldn't. Alex Hayes, that's the author of his autobiography, the author of Roots, the godfather of Malcolm's children. Alex Hayes said your brilliance and breadth of knowledge silenced the black man and shocked and infuriated the white. So it's hard to imagine you don't know about this pretty mainstream Christian holiday. I am kind of, mostly, a Mennonite, and once a year, Mennonites have a service where we light candles and remember loved ones who have passed away that year. It is kind of our version of an All Saints Day. It's been 52 years since you died, and I lit a candle for you today. I also lit one for your mom, Louise Helen Little. I know she called you Malcolm Little, but you changed it to Malcolm X. As a black man growing up in Nebraska in the 1920s, the last name Little was the name given to Malcolm's family by slave traders after they had been kidnapped from Africa and brought to America. Back to the letter. Your roots were nameless, so you named them X. For the millions of black women, men, and children whose names disappeared, X. Those millions of nameless exes guided your life. When white people smashed in all the windows of your house only to later burn it down. When white people tortured and killed your dad and four of your uncles. When white people separated you from your siblings and institutionalized your mother. You held their lives and their gifts. You remembered them and you named them over and over and over again. You named them so many times you brandished an X on your name, committing yourself to naming the people and the actions of racism. You named people and actions that continue to separate people from their roots. You were an enemy of many people. Maybe I am one of yours. Maybe we at this church are one of your enemies. I don't know. I know that I really wish you weren't dead. I really wish people you'd once considered family hadn't betrayed you. I wish they hadn't shot you 21 times. I know you know that this racism hasn't ended and police brutality and racist-fueled violence continues day and night here. I have an image of you in my head face to face with a New York cop, somebody who looked like my dad. He was a cop. And you asked them to release a friend they'd severely beaten. As they refused, your presence and insistence that they release your friend to receive medical treatment garnered a crowd of more than 4,000 people. 4,000 witnesses seeking justice. What would it be like to be surrounded by 4,000 witnesses seeking, demanding, naming justice? In this case, prison release and adequate medical attention. There are many things that Mennonites can learn from you. We can learn the significance of naming particular evils. We can see how an intense commitment to a few witnesses expand and strengthen that crowd of witnesses more than we can possibly imagine. Thank you. In deep gratitude, Lisa Obirik with Hamilton Mennonite Church. So we have Malcolm X, who's maybe more of a killer whale, and we have Katerina Hutter, who's maybe more of a bunny. Malcolm X has teeth. Katerina hopped from place to place to place as she fled. Who are our other witnesses in the community of the dead that guide us? Menno Simons, Alan Candy, Mother Teresa, your mother, your grandfather, an old teacher, our cloud of witnesses. Before I said the first part of the verse in Hebrews 12:1, I'm just going to read the second verse now. Since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. This week on Monday or Tuesday, I went on a hike with Roger to the Devil's Punch Bowl. This is the last story, and then I'll be done. We went on a hike to the Devil's Punch Bowl. Roger and I have been on probably 100 hikes in his almost 2 years on this earth, but this is only the third hike that he's been on where I wasn't wearing him in a backpack, which means this is only the third hike that he's been free to explore. But out of these three hikes that we've gone on recently where he's been on his own, this is only the flattest one that we've been on. So I felt comfortable letting him go free. So we weren't on the side where there's this big, deep cavern that you just fall off. We were on the other side of the road where it's just really beautiful. It's flat. You have these red and orange trees kind of caving in. There's birds everywhere. And Roger, who never, ever goes far from me, was running like he was about 20, 25 feet ahead of me, running in his little toddler legs, swinging his arm up and down, carrying this crunched up old fall leaf. And he started shouting, "Hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad, hi, Dad." And I thought, wow, saying this name over and over and over again, giving him courage to go into this new place he's never been before and explore. So I'd like to encourage us all to think about whose names we are saying, whose stories we are remembering, and how often, when, and where we repeat them. May the community of the dead guide us into a more faithful way of living.